Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live on a lovely Easter Sunday here in East Central Illinois. Everyone in the office here, everyone all over the city, buzzing still about yesterday's game. And we're going to get you buzzing today, too, because we're going to have as our guest a frequent visitor to Media Matters, Linda Foley, president of the Newspaper Guild, one of the most outspoken figures on the future of journalism and media in this country. So please don your orange and blue, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show with Linda Foley. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Next month, a round of discussions will take place on how to balance global protection of intellectual property with universal freedom of information. Such a task falls to the World Intellectual Property Organization, a UN-sponsored agency. Unfortunately, all too often, many of these discussions mirror neoliberal economic strategies. The same trend seems to be taking place here. At the April talks, which will involve representatives of more than 180 countries, advocates for the public interest, for the most part, will not be allowed a seat at the table. The Electronic Frontier Foundation says this is problematic because any discussions that do take place will be subsequently skewed toward the perspectives of media industries and other private interests who make their money off the trade of information. Currently, the World Intellectual Property Organization is evaluating how copyright and patent laws affect developing countries. The EFF says without adequate public representation in this discussion, the agency's conclusions may end up favoring big businesses' penchant for restrictions on knowledge sharing over the public tendency to open information flows.
A big push is on to make mainstream America news coverage look more like America. A strategic plan released by Unity Journalists of Color seeks to raise the proportion of non-white journalists in newsrooms to 20% by 2008. Unity is a coalition of the Native American Journalists Association, Asian American Journalists Association, National Association of Black Journalists, and National Association of Hispanic Journalists, which collectively represent more than 10,000 working reporters, editors, and news managers. Executive Director Anna Lopez says their research into newsroom diversity reports a glaring whiteness to news coverage.
We worked with the University of Maryland looking at the census at the Washington Press Corps and the lack of diversity in the Washington Press Corps in this country. And that's where we started our research, and that's where we're going to be focusing, is really looking at retention issues, at what we need to do to better help the industry recruit and retain people of color.
Currently, only 10% of an average newsroom is non-white, although people of color make up one-third of the U.S. population. Lopez says the 20% goal is an ambitious one, but it's better to set sights too high than too low.
We wanted to make it a challenge because if we don't challenge ourselves, who else, you know, can we hold accountable?
Lopez says Unity will put pressure on mainstream outlets for more diversity in staffing.
Really holding the industry accountable for what it does, from its coverage of various issues to the people that they're hiring, both in the newsroom as well as in management, affect the news coverage of this country.
Unity's strategic plan calls for more research into FCC policymaking on issues of media ownership and consolidation and its impact on staffing diversity. And the group also hopes to host a presidential debate in the 2008 election cycle.
So much for outlawing spam. In 2004, the federal government implemented a new law which it was claimed would stem the flood of junk email filling up people's inboxes. But a bulk review of email traffic tells a different story. Before the Can Spam Act became law, 50 to 60% of all email involved spam traffic. Now, at least 80% of all email is spam. A survey conducted at Stanford University suggests the average American internet user spends about 80 hours every year deleting spam, and that junk email costs the country $17 billion every year in lost productivity and network maintenance costs. And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. 2004 was a very good year for TV broadcast networks. Collectively, they grossed $11.7 billion in advertising revenue. That's an increase of more than 12% from 2003. The elections and Olympics are credited with driving the rise in ad spending. Outside the political realm, the largest advertisers were the automotive, credit card, and pharmaceutical industries. Looking at overall ad budgets, though, the three biggest spenders were Procter & Gamble, General Motors, and Daimler Chrysler. They spent a combined $7.4 billion. Most forms of media saw an increase in ad revenue for 2004, with the lone exception of radio, which experienced a small decline. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters Today on Easter Sunday. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, still buzzing from yesterday's dramatic victory in the NCAA tournament up in Chicago. Joining us today, very graciously on our own holiday, Easter Sunday, from Washington, D.C., is Linda Foley, the president of the Newspaper Guild, the Union of Newspaper Workers, in particular print journalists. Linda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
It's really a treat to have you. And when we scheduled you, I did not realize it was Easter, and that makes your willingness to come on board especially nice. So thanks again from all of us here in Illinois.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, you went to Northwestern for your journalism degree. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
So you're sort of an honorary Illinois fan, right?
Yes, especially this year.
So, all right, I like a front runner. That's my kind of fan.
Exactly. I think Illinois will probably win it all.
All right. We'll probably get a lot of callers on that today, if nothing else. You've been on the show a couple times now in the past. You're a frequent guest, and you're going to be coming to town for the big conference that's taking place on May 10th and 11th. Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, which is sort of a central issue that you deal with as president of the Newspaper Guild, and you're also on the executive board, if I'm not mistaken, the Communications Worker of America, which is the parent organization for the Newspaper Guild.
Yes, I'm a vice president of the CWA. Yes.
Vice president of the CWA, and there's been so much happening that concerns your issues and your union and our listeners are aware of and are interested in. Let's just start going through some of these. First of all, you know, there's been a great deal that's come out in the last few months about a gentleman named Jeff Gannon in the White House newsroom. And then could you talk a little bit about this? This is the guy who sort of got waved through with a false identity and posed as a journalist, most sort of lobbing softball questions at the president. Does the Newspaper Guild have a position on something like this?
Well, first of all, we don't think that it's right for anyone to misrepresent themselves. And I think, you know, at the heart of this situation, that's really, you know, what this is about. This is about someone who used a pseudonym, did not use his real name, and did not and passed himself off as someone he wasn't. I mean, he passed himself off as an objective journalist working for a major news operation, and he actually was essentially a front for a political operation or an organization that had political leanings. And, you know, we just feel that undermines not only his credibility, but the credibility of journalism in general. And for the White House to be at least somewhat complicit in this, in that they did give him press credentials, they knew who he was, and that's being the best, putting the best face on it. The worst face on it is that, you know, that the president called on him, that it was a setup, and that he called on him to make a political point, in a press conference. And even if any of that is even near being the truth, it's another manifestation of how this administration is bent on managing the news and really, again, crosses the line between, you know, propaganda and the worst kind of propaganda, which is government propaganda, and real news. And, you know, the public is bombarded enough with information and spin that they have a hard time sorting out. This makes it even more difficult and really undermines the credibility of journalism everywhere.
So I take it the Newspaper Guild isn't in favor of this practice.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And again, you know, the heart of this is, you know, we just don't believe that anyone should misrepresent themselves. And, you know, it's not about who's a journalist and who isn't a journalist. We don't really want to get into that. You know, the definition of journalism is fluid. The definition of a journalist is fluid. But what is wrong is misrepresentation. And whenever there's misrepresentation, that undermines credibility. And anything that undermines credibility undermines journalism.
Is this a new thing with Gannon, sort of having someone like this in the White House press pool? Or is this something that Clinton did? Did he plant one of his sort of cronies in there, too?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, certainly, you know, there are people in the press corps, even in the White House press corps, who, you know, who have their own opinions, and sometimes those come out in the way that they ask questions. But I think that in this case, you know, this was a blatant political operative. And, you know, this is, after all, the White House press corps. This is a, you know, this is a group of journalists that are, you know, supposed to be elite journalists. They're supposed to be the people who are at the top of the profession. This is a terribly important beat, probably one of the most important beats in the country. And to have it undermined, to have the credibility of those reporters undermined, I think is very detrimental, not just to news media, but to, you know, to democratic discourse in this country.
And of course, the ironic point or the curious contrast was that Maureen Dowd, the New York Times reporter and columnist, was unable to get a press pass to be in the White House press corps because they couldn't get her security work completed, apparently.
Yes, and in fact. There's a funny cartoon by Mike Lukovich of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that actually has a security guard interviewing somebody who's supposed to be a Gannon Gluckert portrayal, and he says, "Well, can you swear that you're not Helen Thomas?" You know, yes. I mean, again, this White House has shown a real propensity and a real cavalierness about managing the news, and I guess what disturbs me about all that is there is, in my opinion, a lack of outrage, or in my opinion, a sufficient lack of outrage about the attempts of this White House to control the news.
I want to talk about that because I do think that's an interesting point too. But let's sort of go through the full extent of what we know of what the White House has been doing beyond Jeff Gannon.
Mm-hmm.
And let me remind listeners, we're talking today on Media Matters, a live show on Easter Sunday with Linda Foley, president of the Newspaper Guild, vice president of the Communications Workers of America, one of the people most connected to how journalism works in this country and trying to protect the interest of working journalists. If you do want to call in with a question or comment for Linda Foley, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Linda Foley, in addition, of course, to Jeff Gannon, what's emerged in a number of snippets over the past 3 or 4 months has been that we now know literally hundreds of millions of dollars have been in White House and administration public relations budgets, much of which, although it's unclear how much, but some of which at least, has gone to pay journalists under the table, or purported journalists under the table, to report favorably on administration policy initiatives, or what you might call propaganda, basically.
Right.
And not be out front about it, not say I'm being paid to say this, but rather act like it's an independent judgment made by someone. Armstrong Williams is the most famous of these people, but there have been 3 or 4 that have come out already, and these are just a few. The suspicion is there might be quite a few more given the size of these budgets. I mean, how does this fit in to the broader argument you're making?
Well, again, you know, you mentioned that I was a graduate of Northwestern Journalism School. I mean, when I was back in journalism school, something like this was just—it was beyond the pale. I mean, it was not something that we would even, I think, in our wildest imagination, think would be happening. It's the worst kind of of government manipulation. And the bad part about it is that, you know, basically these so-called journalists have sold their soul. To be on the government payroll and to be promoting something under the guise of objective journalism is really dishonest and fraudulent. And this kind of practice is, the Gannon incident is one thing. This is really beyond the pale. And I really do think that it should be made illegal. It may be illegal. I mean, there's some debate about whether it's illegal already. But if it isn't illegal, I mean, I really do think that, Congress needs to step in and stop this practice. It's one thing to make government films, you know, like the military has done this for years. The Department of Agriculture has done this. But they're clearly labeled as such, that this is, you know, information coming from the government. When you take what's supposed to be objective journalism, or something that's supposed to be objective journalism, and it's actually, paid-for propaganda. The level of deceiving the public is really beyond the pale.
We're talking to Linda Foley today here on Media Matters. Linda Foley is the president of the Newspaper Guild and vice president of the Communications Workers of America. You said earlier, you know, where's the outrage, to paraphrase William Bennett. I can't help but wonder, as I hear this story, and knowing many political conservatives, that had Bill Clinton been doing this, we might be hearing more about this story, at least on the Fox News Channel and much of AM talk radio, where the story is basically not covered at all. Do you think there's a double standard in how this is being treated?
Well, one could say there's a double standard. I think that what has happened, though, is that the whole notion of objective journalism has been skewed. In the political climate that exists today, which is a very partisan, moving to the right type political climate, there's a real fear on the part of progressives and of the left of center, even center and left of center political viewpoint or politically thinking people that they will be attacked by the powers that be. And, this is almost, it's almost an ideological dictatorship in the sense that, you know, people are afraid to dissent. And so even objective journalism has been portrayed as being, you know, leftist or left of center, quote unquote liberal. What you and I would consider to be objective journalism has been, you know, characterized that way. So I'm not even sure it's a double standard. It's just this whole move to, again, manage the news, manage the worldview, manage facts, spin facts, so that they fit a certain ideological bent. And so it's even beyond a double standard. It's an out and out manipulation.
We're talking to Linda Foley today, the president of the Newspaper Guild, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you on Easter Sunday, where we're all drenched in blue and orange today in the studios. The number here at the program is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We do have open lines, but let's go to the phones right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Linda Foley.
Good morning, or wherever it is appropriate. I guess I'm I wanted to ask about the kind of thing that the browbeating, or I guess it's chest beating or something, the New York Times, you know, fired some people, hell reigns at crew. This isn't too well formulated, but I think you'll go with it. So the idea that, you know, they did apologia for the war, and it was like on page 4 or something, if I recall. But they seem to have made so much bigger of a case out of an individual journalist, you know. Nobody lost their job over the rush to war. Everybody's being sympathetic to the woman's journalist who escapes my name.
Judith Miller.
Judith Miller, yeah.
Everybody's being sympathetic because, you know, Chicago... formerly Chicago-based attorney is DA is going after her, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, she has more to account for than I think than the person that was calling in stories from, you know, Brooklyn when he said he was in Oklahoma.
Jason Blair.
Right. So I just would like for you to expand on that, because it seems like, you know, people are focusing on, you know, this story that has, well, it's a, you know, a racial hire and all of the other things and attending to that. But the fact that Judith Miller, you know, people, you know, the stuff she did from Iraq is one thing, but she was beating the drum on the anthrax story that it was Iraqi connection without any founding at a very early stage. It just seems, I mean, there are other people to go after, like just Goldberg and the New Yorker and things like that. But since you're newspaper related particularly, I thought I'd ask you to go after your thoughts on that story, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much, caller. I assume those are both Newspaper Guild members.
So right. Both Jason Blair and Judith Miller are, Jason Blair is no longer at the Times, but when he was there, he was a Newspaper Guild member, and Judith Miller still is a Newspaper Guild member. Let me just say that I share some of the concerns that the caller raised about the coverage in the New York Times and elsewhere about Iraq, and I assume he was talking about the weapons of mass destruction issue. While I share some of those concerns about the reporting on that, I think there's a world of difference between Judith Miller, you know, and someone could question whether or not she, did a thorough enough job of investigating whether or not there were weapons of mass destruction. She wasn't the only one, by the way, who didn't get that story right. There were a lot of people who thought there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there turned out that there wasn't. There was a great effort to make that appear to be so, and so Judith Miller wasn't the only person who was fooled on that. There's a world of difference between what she did. She was, you know, she was trying to do her job, and what Jason Blair did. And I don't want to mix those two things up. Jason Blair, what he did was fraudulent. He misrepresented himself. He misrepresented himself to his readers. He misrepresented himself to his employer, in this case, the New York Times, and he got caught at it. He actually was stealing, one could say he was stealing money from the New York Times because he was putting in for false expenses and some other things. And, and that was a very difficult time for the New York Times to deal with that. And, yes, people up the chain of command also were held accountable for that. And I can't really fault the Times for the way that they handled that situation. Now, one could say that there were warning signs along the way, that they probably should have stepped in sooner. You can certainly second-guess some of the decisions that were made. But in the end, I do think that the Times, you know, did hold people accountable, not just the reporter, but looked and said, well, where else did we have problems with, you know, that this occurred? There were other people that didn't do their job that allowed this to happen. And I think there's a difference between that and Judith Miller, being duped by a government propaganda machine that was really pushing this notion that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And, I don't think, reporters are not right 100% of the time. And I certainly am not going to argue that someone who makes a mistake or maybe gets it wrong when they do their best to report on an issue should be fired. I think that people deserve to have fairness and shouldn't be fired except for just and sufficient cause. And if journalists were fired for mistakes, everybody would get fired at one point in their career because nobody gets it right 100% of the time. Again, this was a big issue, and again, she wasn't the only one who got this wrong. And I agree that the Times could have done a better job of correcting the misimpression. And then the third issue, the issue about her being subpoenaed, I am totally on her side with that.
Maybe you could give a little background of that, because some of our listeners might not be familiar with this case.
Well, what has happened is there was a man who, I guess at the time, I can't remember what Joseph Wilson's job was at the time, but he was a government operative actually in the Bush administration, and he was sent to to investigate a claim that Iraq, that Saddam Hussein's Iraq, tried to purchase yellowcake uranium, which is weapons-grade uranium. I believe it was in Nigeria. There was a claim that that they had tried to make a deal, and he was sent to investigate that, and he basically came back and said that there was no truth to that claim. And the Bush administration really wanted to make hay out of this claim, and so it was included. Reference to it was included in the president's State of the Union address, and it was referred to very often. Even though they knew they had sent this guy Wilson to investigate the claim, and they knew that it was wrong, his wife was a CIA operative and a conservative columnist who writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, Robert Novak.
One of our alums, you'll be glad to know. No comment. You're not going to root for us now, are you?
Right. Well, no, Robert Novak is one of my members, actually.
Okay.
But anyway, he outed her, essentially, in his column, which is a federal offense. You can't out a CIA agent. And the question is, someone in the Bush administration leaked that to him, that she was a CIA agent. She somehow had connections to this whole issue, and that's how her husband got the job to go do this. And I guess this was, punishment for him debunking this, this whole story. So so Novak revealed that in his column, and because it's a federal offense to do that, for the White House to leak that, there's been an investigation, as the caller said, in Illinois, as a matter of fact, or a guy who it's the Justice Department, but he's from Illinois. He works for the U.S. Justice Department, but he's been, Fitzgerald is his name. He's been subpoenaing reporters because the White House shopped this story at various news outlets, and Novak was the one who ran it. Miller, Judith Miller from the Times, and in fact, there's another reporter also involved in this at the Times, whose name I don't remember at the moment, and as well as Matt Cooper from Time Magazine. There are four or five reporters. Tim Russert was involved in this at one point, who all of whom have been subpoenaed or called before the grand jury to name their source. Now, in many states. In fact, I believe it's the numbers like 36 or 38 states. There are shield laws that allow reporters to protect anonymous sources, because if you don't allow for whistleblowing, particularly by government officials, and you don't allow protection, you'll never find out what's going on, because sources will be afraid that they'll be retaliated against, and so they'll never come forth with information that might be valuable to citizens. So in many states, there are these shield laws that protect a reporter's right to not reveal their sources. At the federal level, there is no such law. So even though Robert Novak, was the one who wrote about this and actually outed this reporter, other reporters like Judith Miller of the Times, there's also somebody from the Washington Post, as a matter of fact, and Matt Cooper from Time Magazine, they're the ones who are being subpoenaed, and they're the ones who are being asked to reveal their sources. They have refused to do that, or at least in the case of Judith Miller, she's refused to do that. And the courts have said, because she's refused to do that, that they're going to send her to jail until she reveals her source. And she has said that even if they send her to jail, hold her in contempt and send her to jail, that she will not reveal her source. I totally support her on that. I think that a reporter's right to keep sources confidential is a basic fundamental right, not just for reporters, but so that readers and viewers can be assured that they can get information that they otherwise wouldn't get, particularly when it comes to the government. So this is a case that, again, the government overreaching and trying to curtail the public's right to know.
Has Robert Novak been subject to this sort of approach as well?
Excuse me. Well, he's not saying, and that's the odd part about it. He's not saying whether or not he's been subpoenaed. We know he's not been held in contempt, so one doesn't know. I mean, the suspicion is that he has not been. And if you read Robert Novak's column, you know that he's very supportive of the administration, and so that makes that whole interplay very suspect.
Yeah, so it looks like an unprincipled attack rather than a principled attack.
Exactly.
We're talking to Linda Foley today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you on Easter Sunday. We do have a few callers patiently waiting. I do promise I'll get to you forthwith. First, however, let me remind listeners that there will be a conference here in Urbana on the campus for free, open to the public, to anyone in the community. Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Coming Tuesday and Wednesday, May 10th and 11th. And our guest today, Linda Foley, will be there speaking along with people like Seymour Hersh, John Nichols, Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, Representative Bernie Sanders, Don Henley of the Eagles. We've got a lot of people coming in, Norman Lear. It's going to be a terrific one-and-a-half-day event. And if you want to learn more, the easiest way to do it is just to become get on the Media Matters mailing list. And you can do that by emailing our producer, Victor Picard, at vpicard@uiuc.edu, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D @uiuc.edu. You only get one a week, but we'll keep you posted on what's happening with that great conference coming up in May right here at the University of Illinois, where Linda Foley will be in person. Well, let's go back to the phone lines now for Media Matters. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Linda Foley of the Newspaper Guild.
Hi, thanks very much for taking the call. Great show. One of the interesting things about the previous few minutes conversation is the fact that there seems to be a greater burden of proof on the journalists than on the administration. I mean, it seems that the administration can sort of trot out anything they like at their White House briefing, and the journalists sit there and take the notes. But when some investigative journalism is done at the ground level, it seems to be much more difficult for journalists to be able to prove what they've found and are placed under an incredible pressure. What I find interesting about this conversation about the idea of investigative journalism, I'm not from this country, I'm from Ireland originally, is that I really golds me to see journalists at White House briefings and at government briefings taking down notes and asking kinds of softball questions that Jeff Gannon asks, and then sort of reprinting the information that they're getting. I mean, I understand that there are people who are trying to do good journalism and get behind the facts. I sort of think it's incumbent upon everybody to put pressure on our journalists, especially our journalist students, to ask those kinds of questions and to really push hard. I realize that when you're being outed by people like Bob Novak and when you're under pressure to be subpoenaed before all kinds of congressional committees, it's more difficult. This program is a good example of the kinds of things that we need to be doing in the program that airs just before this. And I'd ask your guests to push this. I think it's important. Thanks again.
Well, bye. Thank you very much. You know, Linda, I'm reminded, as the caller mentioned, he's from Ireland, that President Bush went to Ireland after the election. And you might remember the story. John Nichols, our mutual friend, wrote a column about it. But one of the leading journalists in Ireland was able to have a personal interview with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked good, tough questions. And then when he gave sort of boilerplate answers, she did follow-up and sort of wanted some evidence. And at the end of the interview, he bristled his aides that he'd never been treated so rudely in his life. This is it's unacceptable behavior that someone would talk to him in this tone. And it sort of was a reminder, as John pointed out in the column, how well insulated he has been from getting the sort of questioning leaders should get.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And this is something that, kind of started, it actually started with Ronald Reagan, I think. I mean, that's my first sort of professional memory of this type of insulating the president from being questioned too harshly or too probatively, and this president, of course, is he makes Ronald Reagan look downright engaging on that score.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is very insulated, and I think the caller makes a good point, but about just spewing back what's given out. I think what needs to happen though is that readers and viewers need to contact media organizations. A lot of times these are not decisions that are being made by individual reporters. They're decisions that are being made systemically in the media organizations themselves about how things are going to be covered and what resources are going to be devoted to stories. I mean, it does take resources to do investigative stories. And if the public wants investigative stories, well, then they need to let the media organizations know that this is what they want, that this is the kind of journalism that they want. I think there's an assumption, it's too easy for media organizations to just blow off the news and blow off investigative reporting because it is so expensive. And you hear it all the time. I mean, you and I, Bob, have worked on media reform issues, and you hear all the time, well, this is what the public wants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want this, you know, they don't want investigative journalism. And I don't think that's true. I think the public probably hasn't been vocal enough about the need for the kind of investigative journalism that I think the public deserves.
You're listening to Linda Foley, president of the Newspaper Guild and vice president of the Communication Workers of America. She is the guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We have a few callers who have been waiting patiently, and I promise I'll get to you soon. The number here, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Linda Foley.
Yeah, there's two situations in terms of special interest that concerns me. One was the how the bankruptcy, you know, just sailed through, you know, the Senate. And then we go back further to the Medicare prescription. And rather than addressing the larger issue of funding, you know, and this tremendous influence, it just isn't being covered. So just like to have a comment on that.
All right, thank you very much. Linda?
Well, I think that, you know, those two issues, which are two very complex issues, they're, you know, they're two terribly important policy decisions that have many facets to them. And I think the caller is right. I don't think that that the issues of the day, like the two issues that he cited, the bankruptcy and Medicare, are being covered, you know, in the way that they could be covered or should be covered, so that citizens understand the implications of these policy decisions that are being made. And I think that's a function of a number of things, not the least of which is, again, to what I was talking about before, which is that, you know, these media organizations, of which, by the way, you know, for the vast majority of the, and there are actually just a few large corporations now that control everything we see and read in terms of news, for the vast majority of them, particularly in broadcasts, which is where most people get their news, you know, news is just a small piece of a much bigger corporate business plan and product that they provide. Some of these companies, like GE, for example, which owns NBC, you know, broadcast itself. The media portion itself is just a small piece of everything that they do. So there's less and less emphasis on news and providing information because it is a cost item. And as a result, there aren't the resources devoted to that to, you know, to go and do a thorough job of reporting the implications of those policy decisions. There's a tendency to just, you know, let people expound upon them, you know, on CNN or Fox News or any of the other, you know, 24-hour news operations or news channels.
I mean, it's cheaper to bloviate. It's cheaper to bloviate than it is to do investigative hard research.
Exactly.
You know, before we go to the next caller, I want to follow up on this because in the recent week or two, a couple of prominent journalists have come forth with some pretty interesting comments about their craft and the state of the craft. One, Seymour Hersh, who will be here at the conference in May, one of the most highly regarded journalists of our time. So I hope a member of the Newspaper Guild. At any rate, he was in an interview. He said, you know, they asked him his comments on contemporary journalism, and he actually said that he's been the judge on a number of newspaper print journalism projects in the last few years. He's been struck by the high quality of a lot of the work he's seeing around the country in the nation's newsrooms, which he thought sort of went against what he expected, looking at too much of the national coverage that we've been talking about on this show and that their callers have been talking about. On the other side of the coin, sort of the worst of times, one of the most distinguished journalist, investigative journalist in the country, Lori Garrett, who I know must be one of your members, who worked at Newsday, one of our most respected daily newspapers for years, sent in her letter of resignation, and quite critical of what the Tribune Company, which bought Newsday a couple of years ago, one of these large conglomerates we've been talking about, has done to the quality of devoting resources and support, institutional support, for the type of journalism she thinks is necessary. So, I mean, there's sort of an ongoing debate going here.
Well, I think that I'm glad to hear. I did not hear what Seymour Hersh had said. And by the way, Seymour Hersh is one of the few journalists who is doing investigative journalism. I mean, if it weren't for Seymour Hersh, we wouldn't have known about Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
He has spent his life, contributing hallmark work to investigative journalism. So I'm heartened to hear that he thinks that there is some good journalism going on. I think there is good journalism going on. I don't think that it's all gloom and doom. I think particularly on the local level, when reporters are allowed to are let loose on a story, that oftentimes they do come up with some really good investigative journalism and really do a real service for their readers. I think that's happening in print media. I don't want to be too disparaging about broadcast media because I'm sure that it's...
Well, actually, Hersh was very disparaging, so you wouldn't... I mean, his point
well,
was this is only
that,
in print.
I think it's more in the print media is where you see it, which is why, you know, some of these proposals for further media consolidation, like eliminating the ban on owning a broadcast and a broadcast station and a newspaper in the same city, are so dangerous because those broadcast values, you know, will encroach upon on the print side. And I am biased toward print, but I do think that there is some good local journalism going on. I also think that these big conglomerates are really cutting back. They are trying to keep their profit margins up by cutting back in their newsrooms, because the newsrooms, you know, they're a cost item. It's not like the advertising department where if you hire another salesperson, you could make more money. In the newsroom, if you hire another person, that becomes another cost, and
mm-hmm.
there's no direct correlation to actually boosting the profits and boosting the revenue, at least in the short term, if you do that. So I think that the trend, the national trend, is a very ominous one.
And this is what Garrett was writing about in her letter of resignation.
Right. But I do think that that there are good journalists out there, and I think as long as there are people who are committed to doing good journalism, that it'll get done. And the good news is that with the internet, and yes, I'll even say with the ability of blogging, and there's some problems with blogging, but with the ability to disseminate information in the way that we can disseminate information now, there are opportunities to do good journalism, and get good information out there. The question is, trying to sort through all of the clutter to get to that.
We're talking to Linda Foley today on Media Matters. Linda Foley is the president of the Newspaper Guild, vice president of the Communications Workers of America, and we're talking about the state of journalism in the United States today. We have a full bank of callers, and I promise I'll get to each of you, but I do want to make sure before we finish the show today, Linda, we have an opportunity to revisit the media ownership question where you and I sort of joined hands a couple of years ago, which will be reemerging, I think, later this year in a big way. But first, let's go back to the phone lines. And line 4, Dayton, Ohio, thank you very much for your patience.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, Dayton.
Yes. I guess we're going back a little bit now from where what you've recently been talking about, but the idea of outrage and the situation with Bob Novak and Judith Miller, I'm trying to understand in my mind how Judith Miller can be on the hook for this problem when Bob Novak was actually the person that outed this CIA operative, and it seems to me that that's a far worse crime. I mean, isn't that a crime? And it seems like nothing is being done about it, and all I hear about is Judith Miller and the other individual that's being brought up on charges for not giving the source of the information, whereas Bob Novak published it.
Yeah, well, that seems like a pretty logical question, Linda.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's a crime that Bob Novak published the information. I mean, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to sit here and say that, you know, that somebody should be arrested for what they publish or what they put in a column.
Yeah.
The crime that was committed here was on the part of whoever was in the White House that leaked the information.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they're trying to find out who that was. That's the scenario. But the caller is correct in that, you know, one would normally expect that whoever published, whatever reporter published the information would be the one that was on the hot seat, not people who didn't publish anything.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
And, you know, and just so the callers understand, what the reporters are being subpoenaed, the reason that Judith Miller and Matt Cooper are being threatened with jail time is not because they're being charged with a crime per se for listening to the White House or for taking the information, even though they didn't publish it. What they're being threatened with jail time is that they are refusing to reveal to the prosecutor who gave them the information, and the court is then holding them in contempt.
I mean, this contempt power is quite extraordinary on the part of the government.
Oh yes, it always. That's not new.
No,
the government's contempt power is not new. What's new is what the caller correctly points out, that, you know, that you have people who are reporters who didn't publish anything about this who are being subpoenaed, and two, the fact that this is the federal government being so aggressive about making these reporters reveal their sources.
We're talking to Linda Foley today, president of the Newspaper Guild. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Chicago, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My question goes to the reporting of military activities in the battlefield, basically. Up until the Vietnam War, the reporters were given pretty much the run of the battlefield. They were allowed to run loosely without being attached to any units and that sort of thing, and were allowed to ask questions and get whatever answers they could and so on, and witness with the activities. Without permission in many cases, and they got support of the high command going all the way up during World War II to say Eisenhower. Anyhow, with the Vietnam War, it turned out that the reporters were reporting something entirely different than what the military was saying. The military was lying about conditions, as opposed to what the CIA was reporting and also what the reporters were reporting. And at that point, the military made it a policy, if they could get away with it, of not allowing reporters to run wild the way they had been. And this has been carried forward under the Bushes, and particularly in this present war where the reporters are embedded. My question is, how do you and the Guild feel about the situation and what can be done to correct it?
Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, embedded reporters, Linda. What's the Guild position?
Well, embedded reporters is the journalism community is really split, and, you know, journalists are really split on this issue because on the one hand, you have, as the caller correctly said, this idea that if you're embedded, and if you talk to reporters who have been embedded, you know, there's certain things that you have to do, you have to go along with in order to maintain that embedded status. And again, this goes back to managing the news, and so that part of it is very troublesome. On the other hand, you will talk to some reporters who say that being embedded actually gives them more access and a more realistic view, at least on the ground of a particular unit than they would otherwise get. So the feelings are a little bit mixed about it. However, I think, you know, from, you know, looking at it, you know, a step back, the real troubling part is not, it's troubling that reporters would be embedded and would have to be, you know, would somewhat toe the military line, so to speak, to stay embedded, to stay in the military's good graces, to stay embedded and get this special access. That's troubling. But what's even more troubling is that if you're not embedded, the military and the U.S. and the Pentagon really feels no responsibility toward you to either provide you with information or to really protect you. And, you know, we have seen in Iraq an extraordinary number, a record number, as a matter of fact, of journalists killed in Iraq. One, because it's a terribly dangerous situation, and two, because there is, I think, a real sort of cavalier attitude toward the reporters that aren't embedded. And if you're not embedded, the military, you know, will not go out of its way to make sure that you're safe at all. And that's very troubling. And as a result, it really does curtail the reporter's ability to actually go out and get stories.
Yeah, you'd mentioned earlier, Linda Foley of the Newspaper Guild, that Seymour Hersh helped break the Abu Ghraib prison torture story. And obviously we had a lot of reporters who were embedded, none of whom were taken through there to witness what was going on as part of their embedded operations.
Yeah.
And there, it seems like, and I'm not doing this based on hard research, but there have been a handful of huge stories that have come across since the invasion. You know, be it Jessica Lynch or the statue falling or the election or finding Saddam Hussein, they get tons of play by our reporters that seem like they're almost orchestrated by the United States government for favorable publicity. And then huge stories that aren't getting covered at all. And I don't know if that's related to being embedded or if there's something else there, but there's a fundamental problem with how this war is being reported.
I think that's right. I think there is a fundamental problem, and I think that the reporters themselves recognize that. You know, there was a case of, I forget what news outlet this reporter was from, where a reporter had written an email to her friend.
The Wall Street Journal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. Complaining about, you know, how she was stuck in the green zone. Because there is another issue in Iraq. I mean, there's this whole issue of safety,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, it's a very dangerous place for journalists. And that exacerbates the problem. But I think that's right. And I think, you know, the military has learned, just like this administration has learned, that they can manage the news. And when they do that, you know, they have success with that in getting their message out. And so there seems to be, you know, more propensity to do that during this war than in some other wars that, you know, that like the caller identified and that we've been through before.
We're talking to Linda Foley. We've only got a few minutes left today in Media Matters. I've got two callers who have been waiting patiently, and I'm going to go to them right now to make sure that their patience pays off. Line one, thank you for calling from Ithaca, New York. You're on the air with Linda Foley.
Hi. The emerging power of blogging, especially last year, has resulted in some political backlash. From questioning their right to protect their sources to proposals to regulate political blogging. It seems to me, particularly after reading some of Bob's work, that blogs in many ways reflect the structure of the earliest print media in the U.S. What do you think the effects blogging will have on the mainstream media and political discourse in the next couple of years?
All right, great question. Linda?
Yeah, I personally think that the effects of blogging are good. I think any time you have a forum where people can discuss or put their opinions out about the day's events is a good thing, and I think these attempts to regulate blogging are misguided and are, you know, frankly antithetical to the First Amendment. However, I do think that journalism and journalists need to play a role in the blogging universe, which is, you know, you can put anything you want to in a blog, and there needs to be some authoritative, credible. There need to be some authoritative, credible sources of information that people can rely on and go to. That's the role that journalism should play. Journalism should sort that stuff out, so that people can figure out what they should believe and what they shouldn't believe. And I think that's a different kind of role for journalism, but it's also kind of going back to the roots of objective journalism and what objective journalism was supposed to do when it was, you know, when it came into its own as a craft.
You know, Linda,
after the onset of the early, you know, the early newspapers and the early bloggers, you know, back in the days of the penny press and so forth.
Linda, I've talked to more than a couple people in the past years who are quite critical of what's happened to journalism and sort of the conglomerate newsroom. but say there's nothing we can really do about it. We shouldn't worry about it because now that everyone's got their web logs, you know, we can just blog on and we don't really need conventional journalism anymore. What's your response to that?
I think we absolutely do need conventional journalism because I don't think that a blogger sitting in their apartment or their home or even their office can muster the resources and investigate stories and look at all sides of a story and find out what the truth is in a way that good objective journalists with good support and resources behind them can do. You know, that's their job, and that's what they're that's what they're supposed to do. And I think that again, that the role of journalism will be to sort that out, to cut through the clutter and focus on what is true and what is credible. I think that what's happening though is that there is an elitism in journalism now that I think adds to this notion that the bloggers, are more in touch with people, and I think in some respects they are. I think that, newsrooms have become somewhat or very elite in their point of view, and we do need to have a point of view that gets more back to what average people think and what average people are doing and how policies affect average people. And hopefully the blogosphere will pull journalism back in that direction.
We've got one more caller for Linda Foley today in Media Matters who's been waiting patiently. Line two, you're on the air.
Yeah, getting back to the Novak situation, I'm questioning whether or not giving, this a reporter privilege to not reveal sources would do more damage than good, given that then that would put the government, the courts, in charge of deciding who is a reporter and who isn't. The Supreme Court has said that we're not going to have, there is no reporter privilege. The First Amendment, freedom of the press, applies across the board from, the senior national correspondent for the Wall Street Journal down to the, pamphleteer. What does the Guild then recommend to its reporters?
Right, given thank that? You. Linda?
Well, I think that that those issues are difficult, particularly in the age that we live in. We've been talking about blogging and, is a blogger a journalist? And, all those questions are important questions. I do not think, though, that's an argument for not allowing reporters to keep their sources confidential. I believe that's a basic fundamental First Amendment right, and if we're going to have a free press in this country, then that's a right that goes right to the heart of that. And we need to decide if we want to have a free press. We have to allow reporters to do their job, and we have to allow them to keep their sources confidential. Just like we allow lawyers to keep to have privilege, we allow doctors to have privilege. There is a privilege that reporters have, and I think that if we need to expand that to others and expand the definition of journalism, I'm much less bothered by that than I am by limiting that right.
So to paraphrase you, you start with the presumption that all journalists are protected with this right, and then you expand outwards.
Right. And I'm not saying that that there isn't a line that could be drawn, and I'm not sure that that I'm in a position to say where that line should be drawn about who's a journalist and who isn't. But I think that a reporter's right to and privilege to keep sources confidential is critically important to their ability to do their job. And if we do want to have investigative journalism and objective journalism in this country, we have to allow that right to exist.
Now, Linda Foley, president of the Newspaper Guild, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to talk more about media ownership. We'll get you back on. This is an issue we'll be dealing a lot with, including on May 10th and 11th here in Urbana. If people want to learn more about the Newspaper Guild and the work that you're doing on behalf of your members, what website can they go to?
Well, we have a website, which is www.newsguild.org.
Newsguild.org.
Right. And there's also the website of our parent union, the CWA, where we're also dealing with these issues and other issues related to telecommunications, is www.cwa-union.org.
Linda Foley, president of the Newspaper Guild, vice president of the Communication Workers of America, and longtime friend of this show. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host. I want to thank Denise Perry for being the producer today, sitting in ably for Victor Picard, who is on holiday. And I'll be back in 167 hours talking more about media. Until then, have a good week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain, the high in the lower 50s with northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a chance of light rain, the low in the mid-30s with north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, then clearing, the high around 60 degrees with northwest winds around 10 miles per hour in the morning, becoming light and variable. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.